So I'm Harry Blaser. My guest today is John Rappaport. And if you are a Solari subscriber, you know John. But maybe we're going to find out about John in some ways we haven't yet today, I hope. So hello, John.
Hi, Harry. Good to be here.
So, John, if you don't mind, I'm just going to ask some questions, and then you give some answers.
That sounds like a deal.
So who is John Rappaport?
Who is John Rappaport? Never heard of him. Well, I was just thinking about a period of my life when I started working as a reporter, 1982. I had spent some years before that writing fiction, writing poetry. Never really got interested in journalism, but then I had a friend who worked at LA Weekly, which was becoming a very popular newspaper in Los Angeles. And she told me that they were looking for an article about nuclear weapons, and I happened to know a guy who was an expert on the subject. And there was a lot of political debate at the time about something called the nuclear freeze, which was an attempt to get countries to stop making new nukes. And I interviewed my friend, and I gave the interview to the paper, and they liked it, and they printed it, and they paid me, and they said, we'd like you to do more work for us as a freelancer. And I said, boy, that's about the easiest writing I've ever done. And I got paid, and they want more. So for the next several years, I became John Rappaport, the journalist, and eventually realized that I could do that and that I enjoyed doing research. And frequently, my research went further than other reporters, and I began to make pitches to editors at other newspapers and magazines. It seemed pretty easy. I would write stories for them. They would publish the articles. But occasionally, I would pitch a piece that they wouldn't like, that went a bit too far. For example, did the researchers actually ever find the virus they claim causes this new disease? That would put them off, and they would get kind of nervous. And I began to see the boundaries, even in so-called alternative media. And eventually, I decided that, yeah, I'm going to continue all of this. I'm going to continue to be a reporter and investigate. And in 1987, a small book publisher approached me to do a book about AIDS. And I said yes, and started to look into the subject of what is it really, what are people saying it is, what have the researchers found, what are they lying about, etc. And I think that was really what sold me on the idea of continuing to work as a researcher and a journalist, because it was both frustrating and fascinating. The further I went, the deeper I went, the more possibilities existed, the more lies came to the surface. The lies got bigger and bigger until finally I was in a position to look at a very large chunk of what I later came to call the medical cartel and see that it was entirely based on false statements, lies, omissions, deceptions, et cetera, et cetera, at an extremely deep and basic level. So that became a role, you might say, that I took on enthusiastically to work as a reporter, and it's continued to this day. So that's sort of part of the story, I would say.
So tell us a little bit about John Rappaport, the kid, where he grew up, where he went to school, and what your education background is.
I grew up for the first 5 years of my life in New York City in Manhattan. My parents moved during World War II to White Plains, New York, where I went to school all the way through public schools, all the way through high school. Then I went to Amherst College in Massachusetts and graduated in 1960, majored in philosophy, which I grew disillusioned with in my last year and a half, because the basic questions that I was interested in, such as does freedom exist, what is freedom, et cetera, were papered over by most of the faculty in that department. Somehow, they didn't look at such questions as being legitimate or real. And so I kind of limped to the finish line with my degree and swore that I would never sit in a classroom again at any kind of educational institution. And decided that I wanted to be a writer. I had made pretty much that decision when I was 17. Moved back to New York and began to write. Did a few jazz reviews for a magazine called Metronome that was going out of business. And moved out to Los Angeles in 1963. I took a series of teaching jobs at private schools and just kind of scuffled and shuffled my way along for a number of years, writing, taking part-time jobs, very low overhead life, until 1982, when I started working as a reporter, and everything, I would say, changed at that point.
Now I know one of the reasons I love you so much. Well, about four different reasons. I was a philosophy major, too. I was a jazz musician for quite a while, and I got totally disillusioned. I actually dropped out in my fourth year for a lot of the reasons that you talked about. But so let me... We're going to get into a bunch of things, but what do you hope to do that you haven't done yet in your life?
Well, that's a really good question. Done a lot of things. I think that I may come up with a new way of teaching people about the power of their own imagination beyond anything that I've done so far. I don't know exactly what form it's going to take. It's already taken various forms. I have a private consulting business for clients. I have several collections, all of which impact on imagination, that I've put together at No More Fake News. I write articles about creative power and imagination, but I'm looking at the possibility of extending that even further in some form or another, and I haven't decided or figured out or envisioned yet exactly what that form will be. But that would be very interesting to me, to empower still more people to look to their own creative potential as the key to their future, and finding that power and applying it and using it as opposed to just thinking about it. So somewhere in there would be something that I'm contemplating doing that I haven't done yet.
You know, art and politics also played a role in your life. Why don't you spend a minute on that?
Yeah. In 1962, I guess it was, I began painting in New York. That was something that came over me as an urge, because I got to know several painters in New York, and I saw them in their studios, and I looked at their work. I had no background whatsoever in painting. And I just decided I've got to do this. And so I did, in a very small apartment that I lived in New York, starting in 1962, I guess. And it was a revelation to me in terms of, it was like moving up onto another plane of existence. Hard to describe, but it was a fulfillment of a dream that I didn't even know I had. And the way it sort of played out from that point was I knew that if I really dug down into my creative core, that my whole life would change, which it did. Relationships changed. My outlook basically changed. My connection to my family changed. Not because I forced it, but just as a result of painting, I had a completely new viewpoint and vision of my life and life in general. Felt much more free. And I've continued to paint on and off ever since then. So that was a major, major thing. On the other end of the spectrum, politics, in 1993, I guess it was, I got very fed up with FDA attacks on nutritional supplements, raids on alternative health practitioner offices. Just made my blood boil. And of course, I was already at that point had been working as a reporter for about a decade. And it occurred to me that maybe I could carry forward my ideas on all of this by running for office. I happened to live in a district in Los Angeles where 20-year incumbent Democrat Henry Waxman in the House of Representatives seemed to be on the side of pharmaceutical companies and against the whole concept of what was being called health freedom then, which was the natural right of every human to manage and make decisions about their own health. So I talked to a good friend of mine and decided, what the hell? Let's go. I'll run in the Democratic primary against Henry Waxman and see how much good trouble I can cause. And that became a very interesting 6 months of my life in a campaign. Didn't get a lot of media coverage. Got a bit. Gave some talks, campaign speeches, a few interviews, and on the night of the vote, my team and I went down to the county registrar south of Los Angeles where the vote was being counted, and long story short, it seemed to us that there might have been vote fraud. I was pretty sure of it because the percentages of the vote that were being assigned to my opponent and me every half hour during the night as we watched the computers never changed, virtually never changed. It was as if at every new influx of votes that were counted, the percentages were split exactly the same way. So I learned a lot about vote fraud. I learned about computer voting. I learned about the difficulty in trying to challenge your computer vote. And the whole episode convinced me that if I were going to be involved in politics in any way, I would have to take a different approach. In fact, at some point in the campaign, one day I woke up and I said, if I win this, what am I going to do in Washington? Because by that time, I was well aware of the degree of corruption in the federal government and the idea of trying to sponsor new legislation and so on and so forth. All of that seemed to me to be a losing proposition for the 2 years or 4 years or whatever it would be that I would be in Washington. So I decided on the strategy, which was if I won, we would just spend all of our time trying to expose the corruption in Congress. And we would make ourselves personae non grata for, you know, everybody there, cause a lot of trouble. For example, one idea was that we would rent out big trucks, and every day we would have people driving them around Washington, D.C. with giant posters on them titled Corrupt Congressman of the Week. And we would have a picture of a congressman or congresswoman. And in one column, we would have the bills they voted for. And right across from that would be the monies they received from lobbyists that obviously created a conflict of interest or influenced them to vote the way they did. And every week it would be a new congressperson, corrupt congressman of the week. We figured we would get a lot of publicity on that, and we, you know, would stir up people, cause a lot of problems with constituencies even back home for some of these congressmen, and just try to expose one of the corruptions going on in Washington. So that sort of became my attitude after my foray into political office, which was expose everything you can. And so I've tried to follow that in my reporting.
So, John, in your life, what are you most proud of or pleased about with yourself?
Well, hard to isolate one thing, but on No More Fake News, I do write a lot about the news behind the news behind the news, you know, what's really going on as opposed to what major media are promoting. And so in the process, I've uncovered a lot of very deep stuff on many different fronts. But at the same time, I keep coming back to the idea of the individual. The individual, free, independent, imaginative, creatively powerful, determining his own future, envisioning it, building it, inventing it, as the cornerstone of civilization, for one thing, and also one of the, if not the, most important thing on the planet, in the sense that if you erase that whole thing, the individual, and try to build whatever you want to build in its place, it utterly fails, as we can see in the collectivist experiment that's going on now on planet Earth. The individual is the rock, the basis, and should be in any political system. And despite whatever shortcomings existed in the Constitution of the United States, it did, in fact, liberate the individual and hamstring central power. That was its aim, and it accomplished that to a large degree with certain shortcomings. But it was by far the most brilliant attempt in the history of the planet, and as far as I'm concerned, it still is. But the idea that it engendered was, we want to liberate the individual to create his own future in the widest possible terms. And in order to do that, we have to set up a political structure that does not impede unnecessarily the individual. And we know from experience, bitter experience, that central power has always tried to take too much. And so we're going to create a system that intentionally checks and balances and severely curtails that structure. So even with all my reporting, I haven't lost sight of the fact that I keep coming back to the individual. And I'm pleased about that because, for one thing, it keeps me motivated. It keeps me percolating. It keeps me alive and cooking. Whereas if I just said, oh, well, yeah, the individual is very important, I'll put it to the side because all I want to do is to write political stories or medical stories and that's it, by now I would have run out of gas. So I'm pleased that I'm making room to do both. And I recognize that some readers can't handle it. You know, they want one or the other, but not both. Well, it's just the way it is. But fortunately, there are many, many, many readers that are interested in both, and so they have been supporting my work over the last 17 years online. So I think that's a really good thing.
We're going to go into bigger depth on some of these themes, but I'm going to go down my list here. What do-overs would you like in your life? Any?
You know, I could think of some, sure, but all in all, not really. Because you could say, well, I want to do this over because now I see much more than I saw when I was 15, you know, or 27. So I would do X in a different way. Yeah, absolutely. But knowing now what I would have done and knowing that I can't go back and do it over, that's sufficient for me. If I didn't recognize that I would want to do something over in a different way, yeah, that would be a different story if I just didn't recognize that. But seeing it, knowing it, understanding it, having distance from it, learning so much more than I knew then, that's enough.
From your perspective, what are humans' biggest shortcomings?
In certain ways, they've been brainwashed, and they've brainwashed themselves to believe that they do not have enormous creative potential. That, to me, is the big one. Because there's an urge in every human being, whether he knows it or not, to be intensely creative. To sit in the present and look at the future and say, what do I want to create? And then to go ahead and do it in the most intense and wide-ranging ways possible. That's there. That urge is there. It's in every human being. It can be damped down. It can be sat on, repressed, buried, etc., etc. But if it is, then all kinds of other problems develop. All manner of other problems develop. And the person fails to make a connection between all those problems and the big, big one that he's sitting on and repressing, which is his own creative power. Doesn't make that connection. But conversely, if you could find a way to unleash that creative power in that person and it happened, he would magically realize that all these other problems were dissolving and going away on their own because that's where they came from. So I think that's the biggest shortcoming. We would have a completely different world if every person realized that he, she were an artist of reality, as I call it. Inventing reality, shaping reality, creating reality, imagining reality as you want it to be and then making it so.
So you've been elected to the Galactic Council as a representative of the human beings. And the chairman asks, would you mind taking a moment and telling us about the most favorable aspects, attributes of human beings?
They will go to great, great, great lengths to help each other. And that interconnectedness is usually unreported, and the people are unknown, but it happens every hour of every day. And it's awe-inspiring. It's amazing. That's one thing.
So, John, what do you hate?
Oppression. Bureaucracy that is robotic. Well, that's the rule, so this is the way we do things. Yeah, but it doesn't make any sense. Don't you see that it would be better to do it this way? Well, we don't think about that. We have the way we do it, and those are the rules, and this is the way we do it. And based on that, you're going to get every kind of distortion possible. The people you should be supporting, you're going to step on. And the people you step on should be stepping on, you're going to support. It's horrendous, absolutely horrendous.
Do you believe there's a God? And if so, what is your concept of a God?
I don't have a religious faith to start with. I certainly don't have organized religious faith, that's for sure. Nor do I have traditional religious faith. But I have had experiences where, let's just say, help arrived in unexplainable ways. Now you can call that whatever you want to call it, and I don't have a name for it. But I know it happens, and I know it's happened to me. And other than that, I don't have anything to say about it.
Do you believe there's a soul? And if so, what is it?
Yes, I do. I think, take the Bhagavad Gita, one of the sacred texts of India. If you read a good English translation of that, particularly the conversation between, who is it, Krishna and Arjuna on the battlefield, famous passage, you will find the soul referred to in several different ways, which I would find contradictory. The individual soul is part of a much larger consciousness or soul. Or the individual soul is itself and immortal and has always existed and always will exist. Now, you could, if you wanted to, try to combine the two, but the way I read those accounts, they really are contradictory, and they're both put forward in the dialogue in the Gita. My notion of the soul is that it is the individual. It's not something he's got in his pocket or in his left kidney. It's him. Cloaked in physical form here and now, in a physical structure, body, hasn't always been, eventually exits that physical structure and goes elsewhere, who knows where, who knows whether he comes back or doesn't or whatever. But to me, the soul, is not affected by the laws of nature or the laws of physics, such as we understand them, in the sense that things deteriorate and run down and get worn out and then eventually crumble into dust and disappear. That happens to everything physical, but the soul is not physical, and so it doesn't happen to the soul. He can try, but it doesn't happen.
So in a way, that does that soul and what it knows and the connections it has kind of remain accessible for other souls? Does it add to the cumulative knowledge or wisdom of the universe or our planet or other souls? Is there that type
of... Well, it could. I think it could, but the problem seems to be that people don't realize that they would have access or that they could share that access. They tell lots of stories, and some of those stories might touch on something real in what you're suggesting, but I think that most individuals are blocked off from that, blocked off from all or even a lot of what they already know, because they decide to live in a limited hangout, in a limited structure, you know. Okay, so here we are in America in 2018, and look at all that's going on here, and we got cell phones, and we got cars, and pretty soon we're going to have robot cars, and, you know, all this kind of stuff, and this is where I live, so I'm going to have to adapt in order to get ahead. So what good is this immortal knowledge that I may have accumulated over God knows how long? What I really have to focus on is shrinking down in order to be able to fit in and to accommodate and to find a niche that will be acceptable to me, where I can have some measure of success, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it seems to me that most of the trouble around the issue that you're raising here is that the soul wants to fit in and wants to fit into a limited structure, and therefore has to develop amnesia around a great deal of what he knows in order not to be troubled or bothered by it. You know, got to become a card-carrying member of the association here, which is the citizenship of some country on planet Earth in 2018. Well, that's a pretty, from the perspective we're talking about, that's a pretty scaled-down version of the soul.
You've talked in many, many ways about the power of the individual and almost the duty of the individual to create their world, to create reality. But do you also believe that there's an objective reality that is to be discovered or known? Or is everything a subjective creation?
Well, I believe that there are levels, let's say, or phases. So on one level, the physical world is obviously very, very real. No question about it. We could call that objective reality. And regardless of the fact that the individual can create his own world, so to speak, there is this physical world around us. It's here. It's real. On this level. But on another level, it's something else. It's not the same. And to try to give an illustration of that, Well, a simple one. Dean Radin, who is the author of several books on what you could call paranormal ability, is a researcher scientist. And in, I think, his first book called The Conscious Universe, he did an extensive overview of all of the published evidence of paranormal experiments at universities and labs and so forth since the beginning when the first ones were done, isolated what he determined were the well-formed, credible studies, gathered up all the results, and his conclusion was that, on the whole, they demonstrated paranormal ability. That, in other words, the ability to do telepathy and even mind over matter, depending on what the experiment was, showed more than statistical probability in the outcome. Well, it's very hard to match up that conclusion with, yeah, the physical world is real and it's here and it follows certain laws and that's the way it is and there's no such thing as exceptions. It just happens. We've got atoms and we've got electrons and quarks and so forth, and they do their thing. It's very hard to square that with the idea that people have abilities that are really not explainable in physical terms. So that would be one starting point for beginning to investigate and think about, is this objective physical world as objective and unyielding as we believe it is? And I think the answer to that question is no, it's not. And what Radin has done, in my mind, which is a very valuable contribution, would be the beginning of that exploration that would eventually, by degrees, show that no, as real as this world is real, as in when a car crashes against a brick wall, there is another level at which that is not the case.
What is reason, and how does it relate to intuition, logic, math?
I spent a lot of time describing that in one way or another in my articles and in one of my collections, Power Outside the Matrix. Reason is the ability to determine evidence. Evidence for or against a proposition. Is the evidence good enough or isn't it? Are there flaws in the process of coming to a conclusion about an event or a situation or an institution or a person? Or is the trail of evidence credible? Now, logic lays down certain laws and rules of inference and validity that are extremely valuable and sharpen the mind. However, after working as a researcher and reporter all these years, it is not the only tool in the bag, because you have many situations in which you would like to have a smoking gun that finally and ultimately reveals the truth of a given situation, but you can't get it. Mainly because it's being hidden on purpose. So what are you left with? You're now left with degrees of probability from very low to very high. You're left with what they call in the legal profession circumstantial cases, in which you assemble evidence that you believe points to a conclusion without having that smoking gun. So reason, logic, investigation, they all come together when one explores a question that he wants to answer, hopefully a significant and deep question, And he understands eventually that he is not going to get to a perfect 100% ironclad answer. Intuition can guide him and does guide him to look into certain areas that he never would have thought of using his rational reason and explore those areas to see what he can find that is relevant to his investigation. And intuition also permits new ideas to pop up seemingly out of nowhere that can be guides to finding better evidence and answers as he goes. And I use the idea of investigations and research because it's a very good place where all of these things come together. And if you try to knock out one in favor of the others, you're going to come up short. Or if you try to overemphasize one at the expense of the others, you're going to come out short. Some people just indulge in complete fantasy, for example, which is, you might say, a kind of a pretentious brand of intuition, where they will make an association between the third letter in somebody's name and the third planet from the sun and conclude something about a plot to derail the production of automobiles in China. Well, that's getting into an area that's just not going to be productive. And in the same way, you can develop such an ironclad sense of logic in rejecting everything that does not absolutely spell out a valid inference that you ignore all the probabilities and a whole ream of evidence that is pointing in a certain direction. So there needs to be a certain mix of these qualities in investigations. And if you want to see how that works, you have to do it. Or at least you have to read somebody else who's done it and who also explains how he did it to get a sense of how these qualities intermingle and prove fruitful. But they collaborate with each other, these qualities.
In terms of another interesting mix, you've been a great champion of freedom, advocate, and also a seer, you know, warning us and urging us to be more free, be more creative. But do you believe there's also determinism? And if both, how does that mix work?
Well, I'm not really a believer in determinism when it comes to the individual. And as evidence of that, I would say a person can become freer and freer and freer, especially through the use of imagination, so that he can not only envision, but put into effect the kind of future that he wants. You could have taken a snapshot of that individual, say, 5 or 10 or 15 years ago, when he might have been able to conceive of that future, but he never could have put it into effect because he was at the mercy of certain ideas in his own mind that inhibited him. And then you could go even further back to the point where he could never even have conceived of the future that he wanted for the same reason. So what I see as determinism of vis-a-vis the individual is the inhibiting ideas and thoughts that he has about his own limitations, which then prompt limited action, limited thought, limited conception of what he's capable of, all of those kinds of things. And if you took a snapshot of a person in that lowered state, shall we say, it would look very much like determinism, and you could adduce all sorts of reasons outside that person as explanations for why he couldn't conceive of this and why he couldn't do that, et cetera, all over the map. But really, you would be wrong, because if you jumped ahead in time, you would say, my gosh, look, this person has now become much freer. The situations around him didn't really change. He changed. He changed in offloading certain ideas about himself and his capabilities. And more important, he added on ideas about his own creative power and confirmed those in one way or another. And now he is, in fact, much freer. So, yes, there is determinism in the sense that a person can load it up for himself and what he can do and then be hamstrung by it. But he can also unload it and become much, much freer.
You've been one of the most outspoken folks consistently over the years about the tyranny of psychiatry. But would you say, is psychopathy real?
It seems to be, in the sense that there are people who are very indifferent and uncaring when it comes to all other people, and they are also violent. You put those two things together, and you know that person is going to wreak havoc. So in that sense, I would say, yeah, there are these people. But to then make the kind of leap that psychiatry makes in its catalog of so-called mental disorders, where they give the impression that they proved that this disorder and that disorder really arises out of some brain malfunction, and they've really nailed that down, and they can test for it, and they can come back with a test from a lab. No way. That has not been done in any defining way. I recently wrote about that a couple of times. People mistake what psychiatrists say about what they've done with what they've actually done and not done. Because there's a lot of techno-babble around the breakthroughs are being made, we have new imaging techniques, we've seen distortions in certain areas of the brain that correlate with certain behaviors, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, fine. You boys in psychiatry have a Bible, and it's called the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. It's published by the American Psychiatric Association. Okay? You got your Bible. Now, all the babble aside, all the PR aside, all of the promises and the breakthroughs aside, blah, blah, blah. Where are the laboratory tests for any of the 297 supposedly distinct and labeled mental disorders that define the disorder such that if the test comes up positive, it amounts to a diagnosis of that disorder? If you had any tests like that, they would be in the DSM. And if you want to torture yourself, read through the entire Bible, the DSM, and look for one such defining diagnostic test for any mental disorder, and you will not find it. It's not there. And people in the profession have admitted it, and I've quoted them. But they go on to say, well, we're doing a different kind of science, you see. This is different. No, it isn't. It's the same thing. It's bad science. It's no science. It's pseudoscience. They collect menus of human behavior and patterns of thinking in committees of psychiatrists who sit around and debate and argue, and they decide, we're going to cluster these behaviors together, and we're going to put a label on it, ADHD or whatever, and we're going to say that it is a distinct mental disorder and it results from a chemical imbalance in the brain. We're going to say that. But we have no test for it. But we're not going to worry about that. That's what they do. That's how they operate. They are completely shameless. It would be as if you, and I wrote this the other day, as if you walked into a doctor's office and he talked to you for 10 minutes and he said, you have cancer. What? Where are the tests? Oh, we don't need to do any tests. I've just been watching your behavior and what you're saying, and I could tell you have cancer. We're starting chemo tomorrow. That's psychiatric diagnosis. Do people have problems? Do they have pain, emotional pain, suffering? Of course they do. But adducing the cause and claiming you know the cause and putting a label on it and saying that you're doing some kind of medicine where tests are all important in making diagnoses, that's an utter fabrication.
Do you think evil exists? And
yes.
If so, what's your perspective on it?
Well, evil is intentionally harming somebody else. And people do it. Now, you can argue about the degrees of evil, and when it rises to the level where you want to put a capital E on it, you know, we're going to launch a war and we're going to kill 500,000 people and make a lot of money is different from I'm going to cheat this customer and charge them $4 extra for the product. So there are all manner of degrees, and we could argue about at what point does it really become evil as opposed to just cheating, and I certainly have never bothered to try to define that, nor do I think it's particularly important, but we can recognize that at a certain level, intentional harm is evil. But I'm not saying that evil is a force that exists and floats around like the weather. Now, I know that some people do, and that's fine. That's their view. But I would say, if you're going to do that, don't let the individual off the hook. Don't do that. There's something going on with a person who commits evil on a significant scale that's right there with that individual. You know, he doesn't need to have a cloud of evil floating through the sky descend upon him in order to do what he's doing. Now, for those people who say there are these clouds, okay, fine. But that does not let that individual off the hook. And that individual could, if he so decided, reform his own actions so that he was no longer doing evil.
So, in a way, Satan doesn't exist in your world.
Right.
But there is Satanism, which would be a human invention from your perspective.
Yes. Conjuring. Let's have a ritual, okay? We're going to sacrifice some animals, and we're going to drink the blood in this grove, and we're going to say certain things that we decide mean other things, and we have symbols we've consented to that indicate this, that, and the other thing, and we believe in engendering as much chaos as possible and destruction of every order that might exist. That's our group. That's our people. That's our club. That's our secret society. And we have these rituals and meetings where we do this 6 times a year. Yeah. You can conjure up a boatload of evil that way. And you can get to the point where, let's say collectively, you have invented it it now has a form that you have put into being or put into effect that you can feel and sense and see as confirmation of your own, quote, power. Now, you can also do this with other things that have nothing to do with evil. In fact, there was an experiment with a group in Canada. I can't remember all the details. But these were pretty healthy, well-balanced people, and they just decided that as an interesting experiment, they would sit around many, many times, and they would invent a character. And they had a name for him, like Bob or something, you know. And that's what they did. And Bob, for them, took on real meaning and existence. And supposedly, I mean, I can't confirm this, but as I recall, the group mentioned certain very unusual phenomena that occurred during some of their meetings. I think it had to do with objects moving around and so forth on their own, whatever. Sure, that, I think that's possible. Absolutely. But the people who do Satanism, for example, that's their religion. That's, they believe in that, and they do everything possible to make it as real as they can. And they want to do evil. And they also understand certain mechanisms of human behavior that have to do with initiating people. Like, for example, if person A can get person B to do something destructive to, you know, really destructive, nasty, harmful to someone else as a rite of passage or initiation, that initiate is now faced with a very heavy dilemma. He's crossed the line of his own worldview, prior worldview. How's he going to get back? What's he going to do? You know? Somebody says to me, okay, we're going to initiate you into this evil group, and the first thing you have to do is burn down a house. I'm just making that up. And for one reason or another, I do it. And there's, you know, somebody inside there who dies. How am I going to come back from that? That's the whole point. The people who are initiating the newcomers want to drag them across that line and keep making them do evil until they just see no way of getting back. Now, those people who have been dragged across the line, those initiates, believe that they must continue to do evil. That's their only course of action. And so they develop religion around the idea of doing evil. It's real nasty. And it is evil.
Do you believe that mind control is possible? It exists, is being used, and essentially that the technology exists to enslave?
I think the technology does exist, and I think it is being used, but I have serious questions about the coverage, let's say, in both mainstream and alternatives, about the extent to which the control works. I think many people exaggerate it. And I think many people exaggerate it in order to make an excuse for their own ill ability to get what they want out of life. In other words, hey, there's nothing I can do. We're all victims. We're under control and we can't escape. That's bull. And here's what I mean. By the use of electronics and electromagnetics and acoustics and light and microwaves and all kinds of, yeah, you can make tremendous impacts on people and on the brain, for example, in the nervous system. You can engender certain reactions and emotions, basic, in people. No question about it. But the idea that you can populate somebody's mind with a complete set of memories and thoughts, and to the point where they are just completely fooled down to the most subtle nuances of their own ability to think and discriminate and discern and so forth and so on, that's a whole other ballgame, folks. Now, in certain forms of, say, MKUltra, the CIA mind control program, and other forms, torture was used. Well, now that's, you know, all bets are off. You're going to torture a person with enough pain and enough maybe chemicals and so on and so forth. You know, all of the really hideous stuff. And try to induce in them, as a result of that, say, multiple identities or personalities or whatever. Yeah, I think that's probably possible. But without the sheer pain, enslavement, torture, you're going to do the same thing? Show me. Show me that technology. Not the promise of the technology, or we did it with mice. We transferred three memories from one mouse to another. You know, show me the extent of this in humans. Make a good case. Let's see what you got. What I'm saying is, especially in an individual who has cultivated his own freedom and independence and power, it is extremely difficult without, let's say, extended torture to control that person's mind in a top-to-bottom way. And I think people have to recognize that instead of just saying, oh, they got all kinds of technology and we're all victims. Really? Show me what they did to you. Let's get specific. Bring it out here. Describe it in detail, because you're saying, hey, you're a victim too, right? So explain that. And explain it in terms that is not just about harassment, which obviously exists. You can aim a pulse of electricity at somebody, or microwaves, or whatever, acoustics, and you can disable them. You can scare the hell out of them. You can terrify them. Yeah, you bet. That's not really that big a feat to be able to perform. But to completely transform a person's mind who is alert, aware, free, independent, reasonable, logical, imaginative.
Yeah, at least that person should have a sense that something's going on a little weird.
Yeah, yeah. You know, today was a little bit different, you know. Where did that thought come from? Do I really want to abide by that thought and act on it? No, I don't think so. I don't think so. So wherever it came from, I'm discounting it because I don't really feel like, you know, going down to this polluted river, stripping off my clothes and jumping in. I don't think I'm going to do that.
Do you believe other intelligent civilizations exist in the universe, in the galaxy, in our solar system, and potentially even our planet?
In the universe, I do. In the galaxy, yeah, I do. In the solar system, not that I know of. Yeah, on Earth, not that I know of. I mean, I've heard some of the stories. And I'm a little bit familiar with some of the extrapolation, shall we say, that leads people to say there are hidden civilizations on planets in this solar system or, you know, inside the Earth. And I mean, I haven't investigated any of that far enough to say that I agree or disagree. So I don't know about that. But purely on the basis of probabilities in the galaxy, in the universe. If the measurements we're being fed by scientists are pretty real about the size of these areas and how old they are, I don't think there's any doubt that in the galaxy, in the universe, there are many, 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 many civilizations. I don't have intimate knowledge of one that I could say, yeah, let me describe this one. I mean, the whole idea that we're alone in the universe just seems preposterous to me.
Do you believe, as Dolan and arguably Fitz does, that there's a breakaway civilization with high technology and using stolen money? And as the head of the Lockheed Skunk Works said, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, we have the technology to bring E.T. home?
Yeah, I've heard these statements, and I think they're very interesting. Could be, is all I can say. You know, I like I said, I understand the extrapolations, that kind of different threads that lead to that conclusion, breakaway civilization. But I haven't. It's not one of those areas where I've said, hey, this is a gigantic question, and I'm going to spend a year or two trying to come to some conclusion about it. So I don't know. I could see how people would conclude that, but I don't know whether, if I looked into everything they ever said or wrote about it, that I would end up agreeing or not. I just don't know. I don't know.
Is there anything you've come across that would indicate that maybe Earth is paying a dividend to someone else, or that this planet is kind of owned or looked at as a subsidiary of a much larger galactic corporation?
Nothing that I could specify, put my finger on. I mean, I've heard the idea, and in a way it's very appealing emotionally, in the sense of, I don't mean appealing like I think it's wonderful, but I mean appealing in the sense that it makes sense in some way. Things are crazy enough on this planet that if we assume that we are just a small subsidiary of a major corporation based off planet, then that could explain a lot about what's going on. In the, for example, the people who run us and own us don't really care about the condition of nations and societies and people. All they want is production. And as long as the quotas are being met, it doesn't really matter how much chaos is caused. That's appealing to think about, in the sense that it explains certain things. It's a hypothesis that explains why things are going as crazy as they're going. So I kind of like it as a piece of story line, but I don't know. But as far as advanced tech is concerned, now we come to something else. I understand that advanced tech is one of those premises on which certain people base eventually the idea that there is a breakaway civilization. And so from that starting point, the statement, for example, made by, I think it was Dr. Rich, who was the head of Skunk Works, about we can take E.T. home, the Star Trek stuff, we've got that. You know, follow-up questions, please. What have they been doing at Skunk Works all this time? A former either head of Skunk Works or head of projects at Skunk Works is on the advisory team now of Tom DeLonge and the Academy to the Stars. And they're talking about UFOs and ETs and so on and so forth. I'm saying, sit down with this Skunk Works guy and let's hear what he has to say, please, about advanced tech. and where it comes from and how it was developed in secret facilities. Because from the few statements that I've seen, the reports that I've read, I glean that there is advanced tech from some of the UFO sightings. The ship was here, now it's there. It's way up in the sky. It comes down in 10 seconds and hovers 50 feet over the ocean, and then it zooms away. What is that? Where does that come from? How are laboratories that are carrying on research in secret in the U.S. and in other places involved with that? What is that? And I have to say that I'm particularly interested in how these labs have appropriated / stolen impressive research of Earth scientists, like Tesla, for example, who, when he died, FBI agents swarmed into his room and took a lot of his papers, whatever they could find, and appeared never to have returned them. Well, that's kind of an odd thing, wouldn't you say? Obviously, Tesla was on to a great many things. Maybe not as many as people say he was, but even what he was not on to, he was in the early stages of. So what has happened in the interim with research? Scientists like that. And if indeed there are retrieved ET craft that have been reverse engineered, I would think that the guy whose name I can't remember, who was the head of Skunk Works, now on DeLong's team, would have a lot to say about it if he would talk. I'd love to hear him talk. I'd love to sit down with him and ask him about 600 questions in very great detail. But, of course, he's not talking, which seems to me a little disingenuous, to say the least. We're going to be exploring the realm of ETs and all of the universe to see. We're going to build a ship that traverses time and space and so forth, statements that DeLong has made, whatever. Hey, turn around. You got a guy right there, former head of Skunk Work Projects. Why aren't we hearing from him? So I believe that there is advanced tech that has been shielded and kept from the public. But I don't know exactly what it is. I sure would like to.
Do secret societies exist, and from your perspective, to what extent have they shaped human existence and even are affecting us today?
Well, I think they certainly exist, and they've always existed. In some desert civilization, the high priests who rule have an inner core, and they sit down and they talk turkey. They're not subject to the cosmology and the teachings and the principles that they use in order to hypnotize and enslave the population, their own population. They know it's a con. They're the major con artists. They're the myth makers and the fairy tale tellers, and they name the gods, and they describe them, and they talk about retribution and punishment and all of these kinds of things on purpose to make people feel guilty, to make people feel that they're smaller than they really are, and all of this kind of stuff. They sit down and they talk turkey. Okay, boys, how are we doing? Do we have these people under our thumb, or don't we? To what degree? Do we have any rebels that are serious contenders that we need to discredit, wipe out, whatever? Let's have a staff report here. Progress. And I get this all the time, at every stage of civilization. It's happening. Then you've got the guys that are controlling the money. The printing of the money, the distribution of the money, the invention of the money, the contraction of the money. There's a lot of money today. There isn't any money tomorrow. Let's get our dupes to explain in terms that any fool could see through why this is so, when we know why, because we contracted it and we expanded it. You know, this kind of thing. Yeah, and then there are the secret societies, you know, the Satanists and people like that that we described before, and you get some overlap. Sure, the pedophilia, all of this kind of stuff, evil. Yeah. They've been all over the place. I don't necessarily agree with some people's characterization who think that they've nailed down the entire story. It's all the Illuminati. Really? Are you talking about the 1776 Illuminati, Adam Weishaupt? Are you talking about the Rothschild Illuminati, who didn't call themselves Illuminati, or some other Rockefeller Illuminati who didn't call themselves Illuminati? Who are you talking about? So I think those people tend to get swept up in various generalities. But no question about it. But again, I don't subscribe to the idea that these secret societies have a stranglehold on everything. Because stranglehold means there's no way out. Let's just give up. Why are we sitting here talking? Doesn't matter. Nothing matters. Everything is done. Gone. I don't buy that. Never will, never have. Can't do it. And I think, again, that some people buy that. They buy it because they want to buy it, not because it's true. It gives them an out. And that's what they're basically looking for.
You have this remarkable series that you refer to occasionally in some of your articles, Getting Out of the Matrix. It's your three-part series. So I want you to talk just a little bit about that, how people can get it, your website, how people can learn more about you. But also I want you to come clean about one thing, because you talked about, you know, these numbers of characters that you met that helped educate you about certain aspects of the real deal, you might say, in terms of propaganda and so on. Are these people real? Are they composites? Are they something that you made up to explain points?
The people are real. They're not composites. They existed, and through a confluence of events involving one or two of them, I met more. They were very reluctant. Well, two of them were very reluctant to talk to me at all. And as I've explained, eventually they said they would, off the record. And the reason was because they were partially reformed bad guys who were retired. And in their retirement, they looked back on their life and they realized that, you know, what was it that Wild Bill Donovan, I think was his name, who was the head of the OSS, the predecessor to the CIA, used to say, or one of his people, you know, we're wild cowboys. We can roam over the earth, destroying, doing whatever we want to, and it's a great life. Fantastic. Well, these people, particularly one of them, was like that. And in his later years, he deeply regretted it, but he was a complex guy, and he never really totally reformed in his mind, but he came a long way. He wanted to talk, but he was afraid. And I wasn't looking for anything in particular at first. I was just interested in what he had to say. And after a while, it became apparent that he wanted to talk a lot. And I said, well, I can give you a way to do that without compromising who you are. You have to decide what to say and what not to say that will protect your identity. That's entirely up to you. I have no way of vetting that. That's how all of that happened. I mean, that's the short version. There's a longer story that gets into, you know, how did I decide these people were for real, which I wanted to do as well, and satisfied myself. Many of these interviews are in the first collection called The Matrix Revealed. And they synchronistically add up to more together than they do as interviews with separate individuals, in the sense that if you read all the interviews with how reality is put together, so to speak, the nuts and the bolts of it, you begin to see much more about how the matrix is created, much more. The other two collections move further in the direction of liberating and accessing your own creative power and imagination and how to do that, and exercises, many, many, many exercises that I developed over a long period of time to enable that to happen if you practice these exercises in a daily way. The matrix, in that sense, is what is presented to us. I have described it in the past as a bunch of mural painters painting a gigantic mural and pointing us toward it and saying, this is reality. And eventually, through study, getting up closer to the mural, looking at it in many different ways, we begin to see details emerge that tell us that this is being put together for us, and it is not just reality. We begin to see how it's built. And then we begin to see, well, if they can build it for us, then I can build my own. Why do I have to accept the mural? And that is, to a significant degree, with many additions, the subject of the other two collections, Exit from the Matrix and Power Outside the Matrix. You can read all about these and order them at my site, nomorefakenews.com, and also get on my free email list, and you can read all my articles that I publish there, which is pretty much everything I write these days.
As we near the end of this conversation, tell us a little bit about your wife. You've actually chosen over the last few months to talk a little bit more about her in some of your articles.
My wife, Laura, was for me, and I think this is true in other marriages for people. I'm not setting myself apart, but for me, was a complete bolt out of the blue, because her capacity for connecting with people and helping people and being alive in the moment and the connection between us developed into something beyond anything that I ever thought of. So it opened my eyes, she opened my eyes to something miraculous in terms of what I knew before. And it's not one of these stories where I say, and thank my wife for supporting me for the babbity boo bity boo. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about life day to day, I'm talking about. Seeing somebody else whose beauty and goodness shines so bright that it just astonishes you. Doesn't just please you or satisfy you, it astonishes me. So, yeah, I've written a couple of articles about Laura recently, and I really have no idea where I would be or what I would be doing now without her presence.
And she has her own business, you might say, in helping people too. Could you tell people a little bit about that and where they could access her services?
Well, actually, she's winding that down now, but she's been a nutritional consultant and counselor for probably 30 years now in a variety of settings. And she's done enormous good for people. And that's just the beginning of a, 37-day story. But 30 years is a long time dealing with individuals on that level, day in and day out. So she's winding that down and is going to pursue other projects, and I'm looking forward to seeing what they are and what creative decisions she makes. We're together, we're side by side. We do some things together, we do some things on our own in terms of enterprises and projects and so on. And it's worked out beyond anything that I could have predicted.
You know, part of the mission statement, you might say, for Solari is helping folks live a free and inspired life. You've given us great guidance, not only today, but over quite a few years through your writings and conversations. If you had a nephew and he said, Dad, uncle, tell me the three or five most important books I should read, or three or five most important pieces of music I should listen to, and three or five of the most important pieces of art, that I should look at to kind of kickstart this free and inspired life, what would you tell them?
Oh,
what would you tell them?
One painting I would tell them to look at is Piero della Francesca's Legend of the True Cross. It's a fresco in a little church in Arezzo, Italy, 15th century Italian painter, particularly the panel called King Solomon Receiving the Queen of Sheba. It's recognized as one of the great paintings in the history of the planet. I would certainly recommend looking at that hundreds of times and seeing what you see in it and feeling what you feel with it and recognizing what a great, mysterious, marvelous achievement it is. And I would also suggest looking at books of reproductions of painting and sculpture in the Dunhuang Caves in China on the edge of the Gobi Desert, where for I don't know how many centuries artists came, lived. Some of them were monks, maybe many of them, and continued to paint and do sculpture on the walls of rooms in these caves. Dun, D-U-N, Huang, H-U-A-N-G, used to be called Tun Huang. And the reason that I would suggest, say, two of these to my fictional nephew is because when you look at these, you begin to understand what can be created and, in fact, what has been created. And you begin to reassess your own capacity to create. That's one of the reasons that these things exist. Ditto for music. listen to Isaac Stern playing Samuel Barber's Violin Concerto, conducted by Leonard Bernstein, New York Philharmonic, especially the last movement, you'll find something else in modern terms. How did they do it? They did it. Here it is. Immerse yourself in it. Jump into it. Stand away from it. Look at it. Listen to it. And then you begin to see, this can be done. This has been done. Let me think about myself and my future and what I can create. Those are the kinds of things that I would recommend.
To me, you've shown that there's great power in being creative, being reasonable, and being empathetic, arguably in being human. And you're a great paragon of those qualities. So you're my vote for, you know, being the representative to the Galactic Association of the human race.
I will take your letter of recommendation to them, because my admiration for you is very high, and if they don't know who you are, then I'm not willing to join.
You're the best. I totally appreciate your time and cherish everything that you write and almost everything that you say.
Thank you, Harry. It's great talking with you, as always. I'm really glad we haven't talked in a long time, and hopefully one of these days we'll be face-to-face again.
Thank you so much, John.
Thank you, Harry.